From Public Radio International, this is The World. A co-production of the BBC World Service, PRI, and WGBH Boston. It's Wednesday, February 9th. I'm Lisa Mullins in Boston. No let-up in the protests in Egypt today. We hear from two of the demonstrators, one in his 30s, the other almost 70.
For the first time of my life, I'm proud to be Egyptian.
Also ahead, what today's protests in Arab nations have in common with the unrest that swept Europe in 1848. Both were fed by new information technology. Today it's the internet and social media. Back then,
it was a telegraph, which allowed a lot of the news to spread very rapidly from one city to the next.
PRI's The World is brought to you by the Medtronic Foundation, partnering with Mended Hearts to provide online and hospital support to newly diagnosed heart disease patients. Learn more at mendedhearts.org. And by IBM, working to help mid-sized businesses become the engines of a smarter planet. Learn more at ibm.com/engines.
I'm Lisa Mullins, and this is The World. Anti-government protesters in Egypt are showing no sign of giving up. Today they rallied in Cairo's Tahrir Square once again. They also blocked access to Egypt's parliament nearby. This is day 16 of the demonstrations, demanding an immediate end to President Hosni Mubarak's 30-year rule. But Mubarak and his government are themselves showing no signs of budging. The president is still planning to stay in power until the end of his term in September. We're going to hear now from two of the hundreds of thousands pressing for Mubarak to leave. Ahmed El-Asli is an Egyptian writer and broadcaster. Earlier this week, he took the protesters' message to Egypt's state-run television.
I went to the national Egyptian television because they were interviewing me day before yesterday. And the first thing I went to say was, this regime and the coming one has to understand that this TV is not yours anymore. This is ours. And what happened was, in the break, they jumped in front of me, four of them, with that hollow look in their eyes. I say, what do you think you're doing? Take it easy, just a little bit easy. And what I did was that I urged them to hold themselves together more. It is that bad, you know, but we still don't know where is it going to settle.
Well, that's a good question. Since right now there is no resolution even in sight, do you have any fear that this could fizzle or much worse?
What keeps us motivated is actually that we need to finish this race. We can't just go home without a closure.
Do you feel as though that's what's happening at the end of the day, that you go home without closure?
I'm telling you, I'm honestly one of the ones that is quite worried. I try to hide it in public, but I am worried. I'm worried they would steal this away from us and not write it in history books, you know? We want to make sure that a real change in the mindset of the regime that's governing our lives will change. And they look to us like the same old fellas that are just changing something, but they're not really changing. When they talk to us, we don't feel that they really know that this is a revolution that should be changing our lives 180 degrees around. This is what we're worried about. We're worried that those promises will fade out, or they just steal what we did. And what we did after waiting very long for. We've been waiting for 57 years for this to happen, and at least desperately waiting for a quarter of a century for it to happen.
That was 35-year-old Ahmed El-Asli. Also among the protesters in Cairo, 69-year-old Shahira Merez. She teaches Islamic art and architecture. She says she's been protesting Egyptian regime since the time of Egyptian presidents Nasser and then Sadat, and that this generation is carrying on the struggle.
I feel very much that they are doing what we always wanted to do, and we are very proud of them. And I have to tell you that in Tahrir, you have all ages, from babies to people my age, all classes, from very wealthy, wearing very expensive boots, to the very poor, Christians and Muslims. It is the first time where the population of Egypt is united irrespective of class, religion, and age. Everybody's concerned about everybody else. And when we were walking in the first march, which was peaceful, and we started to be bombarded with the water cannons, then with the tear gas, and then with bullets, rubber bullets, and then with live bullets, the young people were always pushing us to the back and saying, stay in the back, be protected. Everybody was trying to protect all the others, and people died trying to protect others.
Sahira, what gives you any more optimism about the potential outcome of these protests? You have the advent of history.
I think we have been really abused. The Egyptian people have been abused. And even though some of us are wealthy and can have a comfortable life, it is a tremendously dichotomic thing to see people in front of you almost dying of hunger. This year, we had problems having bread for the people. And it was really very, very hard. How can you eat and feed your children and be comfortable when you see around you people are deprived of the basic necessities?
Hmm.
We all felt that I felt personally I was on the edge of a volcano.
On the edge of a volcano. Do you still feel that way?
For the first time in my life, I'm proud to be Egyptian. Imagine what it is when you see Christians and Muslims hugging each other instead of being set apart by the regime, because this is actually what was being done.
That was 69-year-old Shahira Merez, one of the protesters in Cairo's Tahrir Square today. By the way, following the lifting of internet restrictions, demonstrators in the square have been posting a lot of images online. You can see a slideshow of some of the pictures by protester Sara Rifat. They're at theworld.org/Egypt. Commentators have been trying to come up with historical parallels for the wave of unrest sweeping Arab nations. Some have compared it to the dramatic upheaval that swept through Europe in 1848. That's right, 1848. Mike Rapport is senior lecturer in history at the University of Stirling in Scotland and author of the book 1848, Year of Revolution.
In 1848, there was a wave of uprisings across Europe, really reaching from Paris to Krakow and from north to south. And it toppled a series of authoritarian or conservative governments, and it brought reformists and liberals to power, and they tried to establish constitutional rule where it didn't exist, and civil rights, and in some cases to try to free their own countries from foreign rule.
We should say that many of these regimes had only been around for 30 years or so, kind of parallel to what's happening right now in parts of the Middle East.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, it's true that the regimes which were toppled in 1848 equally had only been around for just over 30 years. They had been established in many cases in 1815 in the wake of the downfall of Napoleon Bonaparte. I mean, this isn't true of all of them, but it was certainly true of some of the more notable ones.
Okay. Now, one interesting point here. There was a piece of information technology, not Facebook, that played a role in the spreading of the news then. What was it?
It was the telegraph, which allowed a lot of the news to spread very rapidly from one city to the next. And so the telegraph was actually in many ways responsible for the crisis of confidence which many of these regimes had in facing down the opposition when the revolutionary moment came, because the news traveled so fast and people learned about it quickly as well, and it allowed people to respond to the news of revolutions in other countries very, very quickly. It explains partly why 1848 spread so rapidly. But there was also the steamship. There was also the railway line. In fact, I think maybe the railway is perhaps even more important than the telegraph because it was a much wider network.
So tell us how that worked. Maybe give us a bit of the geography and how the news spread from one regime to another through steamship, railway, and telegraph.
Well, yes. I mean, the epicenters of the revolts in Europe at that time were probably, I mean, definitely Paris, but probably you can also add to that Vienna. But the first revolutions of that year actually took place in Sicily and Naples in southern Italy. And one of the reasons the revolution which began in Palermo spread to Naples in southern Italy was because the news reached Naples via paddle steamer, which I thought was always like a nice little modern touch. It makes the revolutions have a very strongly modern feel about them. And when you compare it to, say, the first big revolution in Europe, the great French Revolution of 1789, where it took 2 weeks for the news to spread of the fall of the Bastille in Paris to northern Italy and a little bit less into Germany, the speed of the news was quite a dramatic change.
And what was the news?
The main one, the really kind of earth-shattering news, was that there was a revolution in Paris. Paris had a revolutionary tradition. People looked to Paris. And so when that happened, when Paris rose up in revolution, a lot of people followed. And the revolutions didn't come out of the blue. I mean, there was a lot of opposition. There was a major economic crisis, of course. I mean, a global or at least a European-wide economic crisis, which, of course, has parallels with today in the Middle East. And so there's a great deal of discontent. A lot of people were frustrated with the limitations of the freedoms they were given by the conservative order. Again, a modern parallel there. And in the end, once you get a revolution in Paris, when people go, right, Paris is rising up, they follow the French example and rise up. In Vienna as well. Vienna is in many ways the epicenter. Vienna, the uprising in Vienna, sparks insurrections in the Austrian-ruled parts of Europe, such as northern Italy.
Well, what were people's lives like then? What kind of revolution were they calling for and why?
Now, there were two types, really. There were the liberals, the moderates, if you like, many of them middle class or aristocratic, who simply wanted political change with civil rights. Not necessarily even democracy, but, say, a constitutional monarchy with limited parliamentary government. But you also had radicals who wanted radical social reform, a reorganization of labor relations, for example. And in many cases, in parts of Central Europe, remember, serfdom still existed, or a form of servitude for the peasants still existed. They wanted to abolish that. And on that, the moderates agreed. But they certainly didn't want to push the revolution towards, say, a socialist or social democratic type of regime, which the radicals wanted. And here again, one could argue that there are parallels. On the streets of Cairo, we saw secular middle-class students and professionals out on the streets. But then, more recently, you've seen more radical Islamic militants coming out as well and joining the protests too. And there's the potential for a great deal of tension between the two wings of the opposition there. And that's exactly what happened in 1848.
These are some of the similarities. What are some of the differences?
Well, one of the differences I hope we see is the international context. I mean, in the end, one of the big differences I hope emerges is that you don't get bloodshed, civil war in these countries. That hasn't happened yet. And it's partly because one of the differences is the response of the authorities.
And you're saying that there was massive bloodshed back in 1848.
Oh, yes. Oh, yes. First of all, in the initial wave of revolutions in Paris, in Berlin, in Vienna, in Milan. But it's partly because in those cities, the authorities tried, less so in Vienna, but they tried to crush the insurrection using lethal force. And here, of course, the big difference between what's going on there and in Cairo now is that the army seemed to be playing some kind of waiting game, or indeed might be wondering whether they should side with the demonstrators, and so have been restrained. I mean, people have been killed, but they have not been deployed in the kind of overwhelming, crushing force which the conservative order tried to do in 1848 in many cities in Europe.
It's interesting to note that most of the 1848 revolutions failed throughout Europe, but would you say that they had a lasting legacy?
I think they did. I mean, first of all, serfdom was abolished in Central and Eastern Europe where it had existed, and that prepared the way for a lot of peasants to become fully-fledged citizens of modern nation states. The second thing is that some states, although the revolutions are crushed, do emerge and remain as constitutional monarchies. And these become the nucleus, the kernels of the United States of Germany and of Italy later on in the 19th century. And what's more, in France, for example, 1848 introduces universal male suffrage on an almost permanent basis. Another legacy, the people in general enter politics on a scale unprecedented, and the peasantry as well. I mean, some peasants in some countries actually get elected to parliament, which is unprecedented in European history. But this is what happens.
Mike Rapport is senior lecturer in history at the University of Stirling in Scotland, author of the book 1848, Year of Revolution. Thanks for telling us about that year.
Thank you. It's my pleasure.
You may recognize this music as Johann Strauss's Radetzky March. It celebrates Field Marshal Radetzky. He played a key role in crushing the northern Italian rebellions that started in 1848. More news ahead on PRI.
The World is brought to you by PRI with help from the Medtronic Foundation, committed to changing the way the world treats chronic disease. Learn more at Medtronic.com. Medtronic, innovating for life.
I'm Lisa Mullins, and this is The World. Militants in Pakistan are being accused today of blowing up two natural gas pipelines in Baluchistan province. Islamabad is battling a separatist movement in the region. The Obama administration has chided Pakistan for violating human rights as part of that struggle. But the U.S. criticism has done little to convince Pakistani security forces to change their tactics. Thousands of people have been picked up and have disappeared for months or years at a time. Some accuse the U.S. of turning a blind eye, as Madiha Tahir reports from Quetta.
Maharang Langau's father has disappeared. She cries quietly as she tells me how he was picked up in Karachi, where he had gone to the doctor with her mother and younger brother.
After the appointment, he went to get money with my brother. They were taking it to the hospital. My brother said that there were people in white cars and they took my father. They beat him a lot. His hands and feet were bound.
That was nearly 16 months ago. Maharang says it's the fourth time her father has been kidnapped. They call it disappeared by Pakistan's security forces. The last time he was held for 7 months before resurfacing in a jail, charged with various crimes. He was later freed by the court. And that's how Pakistan's security apparatus has been trying to suppress a growing separatist rebellion in Balochistan. Human rights groups say Pakistan's security forces have been waging a war against Baloch separatists, using the war on terror as a cover to disappear, torture, and kill people. And many of those disappeared aren't even activists. Nasrullah Baloch says it's to spread terror among the Baloch. He founded a group that's been campaigning for the disappeared. They've pitched a tent outside the local press club. Family members of the disappeared sit here all day, some on hunger strike, to raise awareness about the missing.
Those that make it out of their torture cells, they're totally incapacitated, mentally and sometimes physically. We don't have any human rights. The government treats us like animals. They pick us up off the streets and disappear us whenever they want.
Anecdotal reports suggest that may be on the rise. Balochistan is Pakistan's largest province. It's rich in resources with sizable copper and gold mines, along with some of the largest gas reserves in Asia. All that produces roughly $1 billion annually for Pakistan's central government. It's vital to American interests in other ways. Drones allegedly fly from a base here. In short, the Pakistani government considers Balochistan too important to lose. Yet, its policies keep the province desperately poor. And that, say Baloch advocates, has fueled the separatist movement, one that should concern the U.S.
I don't think America cares.
Aisha Siddiqa, author of Military Inc. and a military affairs expert, she says the U.S. ignores the problem because its own policies after 9/11 have been similar.
Because it has been routinely since 9/11 picking up people. Making this case would mean that the Pakistani army will turn around and say, hey, fine, then we'll stop picking up people for you. They don't want to hear that.
Survivors and family members have little expectations from the courts. Cases have been pending for years, and Pakistan's security forces and intelligence agencies regularly refuse court orders. That leaves the families of the disappeared with few options. So they've taken to protesting loudly and often outside the Balochistan court. Maharang Langao, whose father was disappeared, says that before this, she knew little of politics. But she's learned.
At first, we thought the government had a misunderstanding. But when my father was picked up for the third time and disappeared for 7 months, we realized that the government knew what it was doing. We were the ones who didn't understand what was going on.
For the world, I'm Madiha Tahir, Quetta.
We turn now to a story that's making headlines next door to Pakistan in India. It involves a university in the San Francisco Bay Area that's under investigation for alleged immigration fraud. Many of the school's students come to the U.S. from India, but federal officials say the university is a sham. Where that leaves the foreign students and their immigration status is pretty unclear. Here's more on this complicated investigation from reporter Alex Collins.
The Jadish, who wouldn't give his real name, the price tag was too irresistible to ignore. At $5,400 a year, Tri-Valley University had the cachet of providing an American degree without the prohibitive expense of more celebrated institutions. But the value of Jadish's education has been thrown into doubt after federal agents shut the university down last week. For Jadish, the shame is too much to bear.
Right now, I came here to pursue my master's, so even I can't face anyone if I go back to my place.
U.S. authorities wonder whether the shame is at being duped or in getting caught. The U.S. District Attorney's Office last week claimed that Susan Sue created a sham university. She raked in millions of dollars in tuition fees, and hundreds of young people, generally from India, got themselves U.S. student visas. Sue vigorously denied doing anything wrong when she was interviewed on a local TV station.
We did not do cheating. It's supposed to be, right? This is the standard we charge. We have so many students signed up. We never force anybody to sign up with us.
According to records, 95% of students who studied at Tri-Valley University came from the Andhra Pradesh region of India, and half the students had registered their U.S. address at a single apartment block in suburban San Jose, which is what tipped off federal officials. The U.S. isn't sure how many of the Indian students were complicit in the scam and how many were duped. The Consul General of India in San Francisco is Susmita Gongali Thomas. She says it's still too soon to say whether most students broke the law.
Those who have found to be in some way complicit with the case, yeah, would not be allowed transfers and would not be allowed to go back honorably. They would be deported, perhaps with prejudice. Where they have found certain people, those will be charged.
The government has radio-tagged at least a dozen students, which the feds say does not necessarily imply guilt. Scams affecting Indian nationals going abroad are nothing new. Last year, a number of students were duped into attending various fake institutions in Australia and Canada. Indian agents working on behalf of lesser-known institutions worldwide is rife. This is partly due to lack of regulation combined with a culture that values word of mouth. So touts for Tri-Valley University had to do very little to convince the local population that this institution would provide an excellent education, as this Indian mother explains.
Since so many students have got Tri-Valley University, I thought it's a good university. We'll get visa. They said like that only. The fees will be very nominal. Second thing, your daughter can work anyway.
The U.S. government imposes strict rules around students' ability to work while attending university. Part-time paid work on campus is allowed, but Tri-Valley students couldn't even do that. The institution is online only. It's difficult to know how many students colluded with Sue and her allegedly fake university. But guilty or innocent, there's no question that these students will do whatever it takes to live out their American dream. For the world, I'm Alex Collins in San Francisco.
The Tri-Valley University story is generating a lot of conversation online, especially on Twitter. You can check out what users in India are saying, and then if you like, pitch in your own thoughts at theworld.org. This is PRI. Thank you. I'm Lisa Mullen. Still ahead, we meet an unlikely blues singer.
I love blues. You know, I got lots of my influence from Skip James, from Blind Willie Johnson, from Lead Belly, from, you know, lots of really deep blues singers.
Andy fronts an Israeli band called the Yemen Blues. He really knows his stuff.
PRI's The World is brought to you by the Medtronic Foundation, partnering with Mended Hearts to provide online and hospital support to newly diagnosed heart disease patients. Learn more at mendedhearts.org. And by IBM, working to help mid-sized businesses become the engines of a smarter planet. Learn more at ibm.com/engines.
I'm Lisa Mullins, and this is The World, a co-production of the BBC World Service, PRI, and WGBH in Boston. Egypt's Vice President Omar Suleiman holds a lot of cards in the unfolding drama in Egypt. He's been vice president for less than 2 weeks, but before that, he had a long career as the head of Egyptian intelligence. And since being appointed number two by President Mubarak, it's been Suleiman who's been negotiating with the opposition. Last night, Suleiman seemed to speak out of both sides of his mouth, though. He said, "We don't want to deal with Egyptian society with police tools." Then he added that if the dialogue with protesters failed, the alternative could be a coup. Colonel Patrick Lang is former head of Middle East intelligence for the U.S. Defense Intelligence Agency. He has met with Omar Suleiman on a number of occasions. Colonel Lang, Omar Suleiman has long been a key ally of the CIA. Why?
Well, it's not just the CIA. He's a key ally of the United States national security apparatus, Department of Defense, the CIA, and everything in between. In fact, I first met him 20 years ago when he was Deputy Director of Military Intelligence, and then I met with him very often when he was Director of Military Intelligence and then head of Egyptian Civilian Intelligence. And when I left the government, whenever I would go to Egypt on business, I would go by and see him, have lunch with him, dinner with him. I enjoy his company. I think he's a very interesting man. He's been a key player in the international world of politics and intelligence in the Middle East for all that time.
But why more of a key player than anyone else in the Egyptian government or intelligence?
Well, he's a lot more capable than almost anyone else, in my opinion. He's a very intelligent man who came from South Egypt and won himself a place in the Egyptian military academy as a young fellow and rose steadily through the ranks as an armored officer. And then when he was a brigadier general, was made deputy director of military intelligence. And his star shone immediately. I mean, when I would travel there, I would meet with all these various officials, including the Mubaraks and Hosni Mubarak and his son Gamal, and a lot of different general officers in the Egyptian armed forces. This guy was so clearly superior in intellect, education. He was a very literate person, very well-read, and extremely worldly, as well as managing to be a pious Muslim at the same time. So, I mean, he stood out above everybody else. And
including Mubarak.
Oh, yeah, very definitely. I mean, he clearly stood out way above the president. And the president feared him, as a matter of fact. He was afraid that he was a potential rival to the succession of his son Gamal to be president someday, you know, when he got tired of the job. And so that's one of the reasons there has never been a vice president announced all these many years, because it would inevitably, practically, it had to be Omar Suleiman.
Omar Suleiman, though, as you know, has his enemies. He has his friends as well. As we said, he worked with the Clinton and George W. Bush administrations carrying out the rendition programs. Maybe you can remind us, before I ask you more about that, what the rendition program was all about.
The United States made arrangements with several different countries to be able to transfer prisoners, especially terrorist suspect prisoners, to them for interrogation, in the belief that these foreign agencies could do a more effective job of interrogating than the American agencies could. So these were government-to-government arrangements. I mean, Omar Suleiman, I asked him about this once, and he said, "Well, you know, I don't run this country. I carry out the president's policy, and that's what I'm going to do."
Right, although he has been accused personally under the extraordinary rendition program under the Bush administration as torturing at least one suspect. And there have been, as you even know from the protesters, lots of accusations against Omar Suleiman. He's not considered a man who would be a departure from Mubarak.
I don't agree with that.
You feel differently?
Yeah, absolutely. I feel differently. I mean, the people in the streets are conducting what I would consider to be a legitimate campaign of political protest, seeking to liberalize their government. But in fact, I don't think everything they say about it, people should be taken at face value. It was Egypt's policy to accept prisoners from the United States and to hold them for interrogation. I'm sure there were a lot of very bad things happened there, but bad things happen all over the world and in a lot of places there. It's really regrettable that they do. If he participated in those things, well, then he should be blamed for them. But in fact, you know, this was also the policy of our government. It wasn't just the policy of the Egyptian government.
So is he then, even you know, with those caveats, is he somebody that the United States should consider as a possible successor to Mubarak to the extent that it wants to back anyone?
No. I think that I would be willing to bet you, and I haven't spoken to Omar Suleiman about this in the last couple of weeks, that he sees himself as some sort of transitional figure to broker a transition to elections under an election commission of some kind. He's 74 years old. He's had a number of heart attacks. He's wounded a couple of times in combat. And he's had a very, very stressful life. Working for Hosni Mubarak was not a treat. I mean, the man, like a lot of Oriental despots, likes to terrorize his subordinates and push them around as much as he can.
Colonel Patrick Lang was head of Middle East Intelligence for the Defense Intelligence Agency. He now writes a blog called Sic Semper Tyrannis. We'll make a link on our website, theworld.org. Thank you, Colonel.
You're welcome. Bye.
A pro-democracy uprising in a majority Muslim country against an entrenched repressive regime. It's Egypt 2011, but it's also Indonesia 1998. That's the year the Suharto dictatorship fell after about 30 years in power. Reporter Julia Simon spoke with one of the Indonesian protest leaders about the parallels he sees with Egypt today.
High unemployment, poverty, and political repression drove thousands of Indonesians to riot in May 1998. When the riots broke out, President Suharto was actually in Cairo on a state visit with Egyptian President Hosni Mubarak. Mubarak reportedly told Suharto not to worry, but Suharto rushed back to an unraveling nation. Lootings, rapes, and killings were both organized and tolerated by the state security apparatus. More than 1,000 died. Amin Rais was a leader of a key political group pressing for reform. He says the army threatened more deaths.
I got a call from the army headquarters. If you still insist to hold the people power, tomorrow morning we will crush the students here in Jakarta.
Rais ended up canceling the rally to avoid bloodshed and scheduled a press conference instead. The next day, Suharto fell, and for the first time in nearly 32 years, Indonesia had a new president. Today, Egyptian protesters in Tahrir Square are also calling for their longtime dictator to step down. Mubarak has said he won't run again, but he hasn't relinquished power. Rais points out that it took a call from then-Secretary of State Madeleine Albright to get Suharto to leave, and he thinks the U.S. will play a key role again in Egypt.
I think the mentality of Suharto is like the mentality of Mubarak. So if Mubarak really believes that Washington has withdrawn completely, that's it. He will step down.
The current Secretary of State, Hillary Clinton, says the U.S. supports an orderly transition to democracy in Egypt, though the White House has raised concerns about Egypt's most organized opposition party, the Muslim Brotherhood. Rais wrote his doctoral thesis on the Brotherhood. He himself headed a major Muslim party in Indonesia, the Muhammadiyya, and he says the international community shouldn't worry about Muslim parties participating in democratic reform the way they did in Indonesia.
When we talk about succession and reform, what is in our mind is not building a Sharia state, you know, but we want to see the implementation of political, economical justice in this country.
Egyptians now wait, wondering if and when Mubarak will leave office after almost 30 years. I asked Amin Rais how he felt when, after almost 32 years, Suharto finally stepped down.
When I saw this old man voluntarily step down, I feel a sympathy, you know, as a human being, yeah. If I can draw a kind of moral lesson that leaders are always trapped by their own power.
Rais says that he used to live in Cairo, and he misses it, especially now.
I love an old song, "Take Me Back to Cairo," something like that.
He says no matter what happens in Egypt, he hopes to go back soon. For The World, I'm Julia Simon in Jakarta.
We have been following the events in Egypt closely, both on air and also online. Stephen Davey is our web editor. Stephen, what can folks find when they turn to theworld.org?
Well, Lisa, from our reporters on the streets of Cairo, we've really had an amazing glimpse firsthand of what's going on as the events have unfolded. There's also several prominent thinkers that have been tweeting, and we've been featuring some of those conversations all at theworld.org. But also, since the lifting of restrictions to the internet in Egypt, protesters in Tahrir Square have been really posting a lot of fascinating photographs and video, commenting on all the events that are happening on social network and what their experience has been like. At the beginning of the show, we heard from a couple demonstrators. Another demonstrator named Sarah Rifat has taken some great shots from what she is seeing in Tahrir Square, and she took a bunch of photos yesterday. We have a slideshow of that. You can check out those photos and explore the rest of our ongoing coverage of Egypt at a special landing page, theworld.org/Egypt.
Terrific. Stephen Davey, thank you.
Thank you.
Prosecutors in Italy have filed a request to put the country's prime minister on trial immediately. A judge will now decide whether to grant that request. Prime Minister Silvio Berlusconi has spent a lot of his time in office deflecting prosecutors' attempts to haul him into court, mostly on corruption charges. This time, though, Italy's top politician may be running out of options. Prosecutors in Milan say they have overwhelming evidence that Berlusconi paid for sex with a minor and then abused his power to try to cover it up. The prime minister has dismissed the move as a disgusting attempt to drive him from power. Journalist Philip Willem profiled one of the prosecutors on the case in a recent edition of Foreign Policy magazine. Her name is Ilda Boccassini. And Philip Willem, how central is this prosecutor, Ms. Boccassini, to the case against Italy's prime minister?
She's a very senior, experienced prosecutor. She's tackled Cosa Nostra and the Calabrian Mafia. She is quite a formidable lady. And, of course, Mr. Berlusconi's supporters say that she is motivated by political animosity because she's a left-wing supporter.
When you say that she's known as kind of a tough character, what is he facing across the table from this woman?
Her appearance is that of a very severe woman, an inflexible applier of the law. And certainly there's a lot of tension surrounding this latest battle between her and the prime minister. She herself has been vilified in newspapers close to the prime minister. Recently, the newspaper that's actually owned by the prime minister's brother dredged up a story from 30 years ago involving alleged inappropriate behavior by her when she was a young woman. It's a very dirty fight at the moment.
Well, inappropriate behavior is one of the accusations against the current prime minister. Tell us exactly what the charges are against Mr. Berlusconi.
The most embarrassing charge is that he had sex with a woman who was under the age of 18, and he paid for the sexual services of this woman, which is a crime under Italian law. The allegation then is that at a certain point, this young woman who called Karima El Mahroug, more commonly known as Ruby Heart Robber in the Italian press, she was arrested by police after being accused of theft. The prosecutors say that Mr. Berlusconi was alerted to her problem and he called police headquarters in Milan to ask them to release her because she was either the niece or the granddaughter of President Mubarak of Egypt.
By the way, she's not related to Mubarak, I take it.
Absolutely not at all. No. She's Moroccan and has no connection to him whatsoever.
Well, Mr. Berlusconi says that the phone call to police was an innocent attempt to help her out. He said that he did not pay Ruby for sex. If he is found guilty, though, on these charges, what kind of punishment does he face?
The charge of having sex with an underage prostitute carries a prison sentence of up to 3 years. The abuse of power is seen as a more serious crime and I believe the potential limit for imprisonment would be up to 11 years.
Could this potentially, I mean, Berlusconi is always facing one accusation or another, mostly, as we said, corruption charges. Could these charges about his sexual activity, in some cases criminal sexual activity, be the end of his political career?
The Italian public seems to be extraordinarily tolerant of what other countries would consider eccentric or unacceptable behavior. Evidence of sleaze is not really enough to hurt the prime minister seriously or put an end to his political career. But I think a conviction would be a very different matter.
All right. Thank you very much. Philip Willen, Rome-based journalist and author of two books on Italy's Cold War history, talking about the latest charges against Italy's prime minister. Thanks very much.
Pleasure.
Coming up tomorrow on The World, Mexican drug traffickers have worked their way south into Guatemala. The Guatemalan army has been trying to beat them back, but some Guatemalans say they feel loyal to the drug cartels. The Mexican drug war heads south tomorrow on The World. Listening to The World on PRI. I'm Lisa Mullins, and this is The World. We are racing with the Huskies for today's GeoQuiz. The Yukon Quest is underway. 25 mushers and their sled dogs left Whitehorse in Canada's Yukon Territory on Sunday. They're headed northwest to Fairbanks, Alaska, 1,000 miles away as the dogs run. The race retraces snowy routes that were used well before the age of snowmobiles during the Gold Rush. Wendy Morrison is one of the race organizers.
Well, I'm here at the halfway mark for the Yukon Quest, and we have had our top 10 mushers arrive into the early hours of the morning, and we have 100 people hanging out at the checkpoint waiting for our next mushers to come in. It's very exciting here.
That's the sound of 100 pairs of mittens clapping as those tired doggies reach the halfway point between Whitehorse and Fairbanks. And the name of that halfway checkpoint is? Well, the answer is a northern city that was once a bustling mix of mining supply shops, camps, and saloons during the Klondike Gold Rush. As the mushers drive their sleds into the checkpoint, they come in along the Yukon River.
Often we'll see headlamps coming along the river and up towards the checkpoint. It's a real sense of anticipation. People can't wait to see the teams, can't wait to see the dogs. We've all been up until the wee hours of the morning watching each team come in.
Now, you might still be spreading out your maps to locate this old gold town, but we're going to cut to the chase. The answer is Dawson, or Dawson City, the halfway point of the race. Mushers have come from as far away as Australia, France, and Norway to compete. When a musher arrives in Dawson, Morrison says the team has to take a break.
As soon as the official part of the check-in is done, he goes and greets all of his dogs and gives them a big pat and thanks them for a great run. And then he gets back on his sled and heads over to the campground where he'll bed down his dogs. They're here for a 36-hour mandatory layover, so it's a really good opportunity for the dogs and the musher to get a really good rest.
A much-deserved rest. The sled dogs have been running more than 200 miles since the last checkpoint, and it's a chilly rest as well. The temperature in Dawson this morning was around minus 22 and windy. Mushers and dogs still have another 500 miles to go before they reach Fairbanks. Next stop, Eagle, Alaska. And finally, the subject of our global hit today, it's a band called Yemen Blues. Now, don't let the name of the group confuse you. They are sort of from Yemen. They're also sort of bluesy. The World's Marco Werman clears up the rest.
Ravid Kahalani makes music that won't sound to you like 12-bar blues, but he feels it.
I love blues. You know, I got lots of my influence from Skip James, from Blind Willie Johnson, from Lead Belly, from, you know, lots of really deep blues singers.
جاي ما حبادي هذا تمم عائل غانا
غانا
والكلام الحلي مشلي.
Now here's another thing that might confuse some newcomers to Yemen blues. Kahalani is from Israel. His parents come from Yemen. So what does that make him?
And most of the people, like, are you Arab or Jew? You know, it's like, I am Arab. I am Arab Jew. But this is part of the process of the Yemen blues that I experienced, that I missed something of my own culture that was there like 50 years ago.
So you listen to the music of Yemen blues, and it sounds mostly Arabic. Then it turns out that it's actually rooted in Jewish Yemenite music. For Ravid Kahalani, that Yemenite music is dear to him. He listened to it as a kid, but for a long time in Israel, it was tantamount to Arabic music.
It used to be in the 50s when my parents came to Israel. It wasn't so cool to be like an Arab. But we have now, these days, we have a big appreciation as the Yemenite community. We express ourselves much more in the last years. It's no longer a bad thing.
Or, let's say, in some pockets of the cultural mashup that is Israel today, it is kind of cool to have Arab roots. But at a Yemen blues concert, the last thing Kahalani wants the audience to think about is identity politics. There are a few tracks on Yemen Blues' just released debut CD that capture what this band's concerts are about. There is a big difference, though, seeing Yemen Blues and Ravid Kahalani live. On stage, his eyeballs often roll to the back of his head, and he seems authentically to drift into a trance. Ravid Kahalani is a true believer in the power of music, the blues, and in the power of Yemen blues, that they can do what politicians in the Mideast have long been unable to.
There is many gods and many politicians, but there is one thing that I call the moment of the soul that we have all together. When you go to a concert, you listen to some music, and you don't understand the language. You just feel the moment of the soul. You feel that you connect to it really, really clear, and it touches you. And I want people, you know, people, they enjoy the entertainment and then they're going back straight to their everyday life. I want people to take this moment of the soul from the concert out of the concert hall, you know, like to take it as a way of life. This whole thing is the same thing, it's just the soul music. The Yemenite guy that's singing the chants in Yemen, or an Afro-American guy that's singing in Memphis, the blues, it's the same thing.
For the world, I'm Marco Werman.
הקבינט דרך העולם ואת דרכנו כאן איך שאת ואני מנסים להבין את דרך העולם ואת דרכנו כאן פרם פם פרם
Got a bad case of Yemen blues? Go to theworld.org to check out a great video of the band in the studio recording their song Yamin Aleman. From the Nana Bill Harris Studios at WGBH in Boston, I'm Lisa Mullins. We're back tomorrow.
Is a co-production of the BBC World Service, PRI, and WGBH Boston, supported in part by the National Science Foundation, where discoveries begin, nsf.gov, the United States Institute of Peace, helping to prevent, manage, and resolve violent international conflict, online at usip.org, and the PRI Program Fund, whose donors support the critical work of the nonprofit sector. Contributors include the Ford Foundation and the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, committed to building a more just, verdant, and peaceful world. MacFound.org.
PRI, Public Radio International.